You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 9th, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, co-host Nate and I discuss violent right-wing extremism in the United States and Europe, plus the problems with FIFA. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from wvud.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is my co-host, Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
So the first story that we're going to be talking about is another shooting event that happened, except we're not going to be talking about the gun control aspect since we covered that pretty thoroughly last week. We're going to be talking instead about the political angle. So this past Sunday, there was a shooting in a Las Vegas shopping center, which was an act of domestic terrorism. The perpetrators, it has turned out, were radical anti-government right-wingers who had neo-Nazi stuff clearly stated materials present in their apartment, and also that there was that they were tied to the Bundy Ranch standoff, which we'll get to in a moment. This is obviously a story that we had talked about several weeks ago on the show Arsenal for Democracy. And you can read more about this on arsenalfordemocracy.com, of course, but we're going to talk about it here today, their political leanings. So the incident basically was that a man and a woman ran into a pizza shop and shot dead without warning, point blank, two police officers from the local Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and they yelled something along the lines of "This is the start of the revolution" or something like that, and then later yelled "We're freedom fighters," and they also gunned down a random passerby, and then one of them shot the other and then shot herself.
Apparently they also left a "Don't Tread on Me" flag and a swastika on top of the bodies of the police officers.
Right. So lovely. I think that, yeah, the at the point where they're leaving "Don't Tread on Me" Gadsden flags on the bodies of the police officers, this is pretty clearly an act of political terrorism, even before you get to this Bundy Ranch connection. And I think it is important to call this terrorism. I mean, the last time we did the segment, we had a discussion about when do you cross that line between not terrorist and terrorist, and Nate said, well, when they start shooting, it's terrorism, and these particular breakaway factions,
yes,
started
these are
shooting.
Terrorists.
So these are terrorists. Now, again, that doesn't mean let's make a huge thing out of it necessarily, but as long as everyone's going to freak out about the non-white terrorists and the non-right-wing, you know, terrorists are usually Christian affiliated in these cases, or some extremist strain of Christianity. You know, if they're people aren't freaking out about that in the same way that they freak out about radical Islamic terrorism and other forms of terrorism by non-white people, and that's a problem, because it should be the same. They should all generally be treated the same, which is to address the root causes and to deal with them as criminal enterprises. L. Paul Bremer, who later became the occupation governor of Iraq under the Bush administration and was an ambassador to various countries, he was the top policy official on counterterrorism in the State Department under the Reagan administration. So one of the more conservative administrations you can get in the modern era, and obviously one that many, you know, Tea Party people and stuff are very fond of, maybe through rose-colored historical glasses. But Paul Bremer said, "Another important measure we have developed in our overall strategy is applying the rule of law to terrorists. Terrorists are criminals. They commit criminal actions like murder, kidnapping, and arson, and countries have laws to punish criminals. So a major element of our strategy has been to delegitimize terrorists, to get society to see them for what they are, criminals, and to use democracy's most potent tool, the rule of law, against them." And I think that's a really important point, because too much of the policy in the late 1990s, and then especially after 9/11, has been to treat terrorists, for the most part, as these sort of mythical, destructive figures that have to be hunted to the ends of the earth.
They have basically superpowers, so, I mean, we need to do everything we can to stop them, and that includes, you know, war-like weapons, tanks, guns, planes, missiles, all sorts of fun things like those.
My view, and I think Nate generally shares this view, is let's stop glorifying the terrorists by making them into these superhuman figures. Let's treat them as the criminals and murderers that they are.
I mean, if you look at some of the actual details of like individual terrorists and various attempts or plots that have been foiled, most of them are shockingly stupid. So
right.
Let's stop pretending like that they're somehow, you know, these criminal masterminds. I think they more or less got lucky on 9/11, caught us with our pants down, and you know, we've sort of been overreacting to that ever since. Right. Not that there aren't serious threats out there, but I think pretending like it's a war is definitely counterproductive.
The problem is you can't prevent all of these attacks, but you got to treat these things not as this global warfare front, whether it's at home or abroad. You've got to treat them as these, you know, ridiculous criminal enterprises that they are. I mean, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is clearing millions of dollars a year in extortionary bribes and ransom payments from European countries, governments and companies in exchange for releasing people that they've kidnapped. And that just goes to the point that Bremer made in that document back in the 1980s, which is that these groups invariably commit crimes that are already crimes. They're nothing special about the crimes except that they have these ideological motivations. But we've got to make a decision here. Are we going to treat these things uniformly as ideologically motivated, or are we going to treat some of them as special and some of them as not? And that's the problem, is it starts to break down the rule of law in general if you start applying these extraordinary measures to one group of people and then not to another. It should be consistent, which is why when these things happen and it doesn't fit that mold of what the popular imagination of a terrorist is, I think it's important to point out that these are terrorists, because that helps kind of demystify what's going on in these various attacks. These guys basically, or this guy and this woman, went up to these police officers, shot them dead, and that's an act of terrorism. And yeah, it's murder, but it's an act of terrorism, and it should be prosecuted as murder, or in this case, probably it's going to be prosecuted. Well, it wouldn't be prosecuted because they're not alive, but if they were alive, it would have been probably handled as a standard cop killing. And that's the thing, is it should be handled within these sort of separate frames of mind, because it only just encourages these sort of dramatic propaganda of the deed acts. That's the term from the anarchist movement, where they thought that, oh, if I go assassinate the Tsar of Russia with a bomb, or if I go assassinate William McKinley at the World Fair, that this is going to inspire a mass uprising. And that's what the people yelled in this case, was, this is the start of the revolution.
Never happens.
And it never happens like that, but it encourages more such actions by people who do think that that's going to work. It encourages people to do that more frequently. And if we instead said for all of these, this is an act of terrorism, but they will be handled as standard murder, you know, unless it's a government official, in which case it's a standard murder of a government official, that kind of delegitimizes this propaganda of the deed approach and makes it even less effective and less attractive to people who are potentially going to be engaging in stuff like this. And that's the lesson that I take away from here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that really shocked us about 9/11 was just how it was on such a large scale, and just the complete destruction of two buildings and multiple planes being involved and all of that. And then that was sort of it had the wow factor that really led us all to become very afraid of the prospect of terrorism. And then we, of course, invented all the stuff with Iraq and the possibilities of various chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons being deployed against us. But now, I mean, it seems, you know, just how we're seeing global terrorism in this decade, it looks like the vast majority of the incidents are relatively small, you know, IEDs, bombings, kidnappings, murders, more just personal, in some ways more petty types of crimes, bribery, extortion, things like that. And so it's obviously way easier to talk about it being a law enforcement type operation if those are the things we're dealing with, rather than planes flying into buildings and then the buildings falling down. So, I mean, I think this actually does play into our hands a little bit nicely, in that we're not having, at least for now, to deal with these giant plots, and we're just sort of foiling these more isolated type incidents. You know, hopefully we're never going to have to deal with those things again, but obviously, you know, we still have to be on guard for them. But this is more of a law enforcement type situation right now, especially.
So let's get into the politics a little bit here. you know, in the past, there's been right-wing extremism, there's been left-wing extremism, but that seems to have mostly drifted into the past. For all the talk that got brought up in 2008 about Bill Ayers and the Weather Underground, I mean, that stuff was happening in the 1960s and kind of, you know, has really dissipated since then. The similar radical left terrorist attacks in Europe that were pretty common kind of petered out in the 70s and 80s. And so mostly what we've seen now is this sort of concentration of these domestic attacks around a far-right ideology, which is obviously not held by the mainstream conservatives or mainstream Republicans. But the problem is that within the Republican Party and within the conservative movement, there is incorporation of this fringe in the United States. And that does pose a bit of a problem. And there hasn't been enough repudiation. Moreover, a lot of the repudiation seems to come in the form of just trying to say that there's no connection whatsoever here. And the reality is that there is a connection there. You know, a lot of it's taking some of the positions to their extreme endpoint, but also it's just that there is, you know, when you have the party willing to take kind of lighter versions of these anti-immigrant policies or rhetoric, you know, self-deportation and things like that. You know, if you say, oh, we want to make it as miserable for the immigrants to be here as possible so they'll leave, I mean, somebody's going to take that then to the next step and say, well, let's help the process along and things like that. Now, in this case, it didn't involve that.
I mean, that's a logical step, Bill. I mean...
So what we see in these situations then is that somebody just goes all the way with it. So in this case, it had to do with the Bundy Ranch standoff. This shooting happened in Las Vegas, and as we discussed previously on the show, the standoff there happened a little bit outside of Las Vegas in the state of Nevada on public lands. And what it seems like is that these particular shooters who were ejected by the people at the Bundy Ranch, I guess to their credit, the people who were involved in this shooting here, their position was that they got tired of waiting around and they wanted to shoot some government officials, and they didn't like just pointing weapons threateningly at them. And so this was their grand plan, was that they were going to go shoot some government officials and put some "don't tread on me" flags on them and that sort of thing. And according to the reporting done by the Las Vegas Sun, quote, "residents who spoke about the Millers all mentioned the couple's relationship with Bundy. Oak Tree resident Sue Hale said the two told her they were in Bunkerville during the standoff, which occurred in April after federal authorities began conducting a roundup of Bundy's cattle. Bundy had defied the government by grazing the cattle on public land without a permit." She said that, quote, "they were always running their mouths about the situation there." And furthermore, the Las Vegas Sun says, "after killing the officers, the couple covered their bodies with the cloth displaying the Gadsden or Don't Tread on Me flag, Revolutionary War era symbol that has been adopted by the Tea Party. Investigators also found swastikas at the suspect's apartment." So the Bundys saying there's no connection, saying that they kicked them off. But if you look at the social media posts from these people, you know, they had said that they had been kicked out of the ranch, that, you know, one of them had a felony conviction, and the Bundy people and their supporters didn't want to be made to, you know, they looked bad. And this really leads into this fundamental issue, which happens anytime any of these happen, which is you can try to distance yourself, but you got to look at the relationship between the words that you're advocating and then the actions that some people take them to. Are you in fact inciting some people who maybe are unstable or something, or susceptible to these pressures? Are you putting out rhetoric that they're going to take to that next level? And in fact, even within the outright hate group movements, you know, far divorced from the Republican Party or the conservative movement or anything, the actual out and out white supremacist groups, they say the same things when someone does an attack, right? So if someone goes and kills a bunch of people as a white supremacist attack or blows up a building or something, they also say, well, I never told anyone to use violence. And it says, well, you used violent rhetoric for years and basically planted the seeds in their head, and then told them, don't connect us back to you if you do anything. It's a very deliberate strategy. And in this case, I would just be wary about the idea that they're distancing themselves from this. Of course, they're going to distance themselves from it. But it gets into that issue of what's incitement versus actually committing violence.
Yeah, Bill, and there was a couple quotes that came out from Bundy shortly after our last segment on him. I wouldn't necessarily say these are inciting violence, but I think they do reveal a little bit into Bundy's mindset. He talks about seeing a public housing project in North Las Vegas and just people sitting around, half a dozen people on the porch. Obviously, these are black people he's talking about. And later in the quote, he said, they were basically on government subsidies, so what do? They abort their young children, they put their men in jail because they never learned how to pick cotton. I guess that, just throwing that in out of nowhere. And I've always wondered, were they better off, are they better off as slaves picking cotton, have a family life and doing things, or are they better off under government subsidy? They didn't get no more freedom, they got less freedom. And shortly after that, a bunch of Republican senators, including Dean Heller and Rand Paul, who had previously sort of supported Bundy's stance against the Bureau of Land Management, they sort of just had to come out and say, hey, we don't support those appalling and racist statements, and we're just going to back off now. So we basically alienated some of his mainstream support with those quotes. I mean, this is, we've heard these, basically these exact same quotes from a lot of different sources over the past couple of years, somehow trying to basically say, hey, at least people were given food during slavery, so therefore it's cool. I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this last quote. They didn't get no more freedom, they got less freedom. I'm pretty sure if someone's a slave and then becomes not a slave, that's a net gain of freedom, just almost by definition. If you're being given money in the form of government subsidies, I mean, yes, you can have this like abstract philosophical argument how that makes you a slave to the government. Oh, no. But I mean, that's not the same thing as having chains around your wrist. So let's not even start with that.
Right. I think there's this perception, misperception, that American slavery was just super low wage employment. As opposed to, you know, because you'll hear
in
these
nice big houses,
right? You'll hear these Duck Dynasty type guys or Clive and Bundy talking about, you know, oh well, they got their housing provided for them and they got their food provided for them, and so clearly they weren't, you know, they were getting paid. And it's
bet there were just like big feasts up at the manor house, and everyone was invited to join in, and they got the best highest quality food and clothes, and they probably slept. You know, they had their own personal bedrooms inside the manor house. I'm sure it was just great. Just lovely.
And it's just, it's this crazy refusal to recognize that this was chattel slavery, where your physical freedom of movement is legally restricted and you are nothing more than property. You have no more rights as a person than the person who owns you that their horse has or something, right? You
like
can
share of stock or something.
Yeah,
like
you can
hold on to it until the asset is not good enough or it's not making you the money you want, and then you sell it off somewhere. And then, I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not people. Like,
right. It was completely.
How can you say you get less freedom because you're being given money by the government in the form of a subsidy because you're unemployed or something? It just makes no sense.
Right. And it's so mind-blowingly wrong. And, you know, I think that there's a lot to do with this.
I like how he just throws in the never learned how to pick cotton thing out of nowhere, as if that's the only thing that black people are good for is picking cotton.
Well, that and that the idea that this was, that again, this was low wage employment, but there was jobs training involved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Real good job training.
Right.
Applicable in the 21st century.
Yeah, the problem is that there's this sort of warped like ideology that of how things used to be, and that we have to go back to this time. Now, a lot of it he just makes up. I mean, last segment we talked at great length about his bizarre theories of how Nevada was actually not subject to federal jurisdiction or whatever, and he didn't recognize the existence of the federal government
to save the tortoise, the desert tortoise.
Yeah, he had to save the desert tortoise. But the other thing that happens here is that you get these just so ahistorically creative fictional universes. Obviously the slavery myth stuff is one of them, and that's perhaps the most destructive. But then there's just all these other strange things. For example, this is a direct quote from Clive and Bundy referring to the Pilgrims. They had a central government, which was Europe, was the strongest army in the world, and they ruled with unlimited power.
England did not have the strongest army in the world at that time.
And there was a point that they decided they wasn't going to live that way anymore, and so they had a revolution. which he's now constricted down the entire history of the Pilgrims from 1620 to 1776. He's mashed that all down, combined all of the governments of Europe into one thing. And this is during the period when all of Europe was fighting in the 30 Years' War, right before the English Civil War, when all the reforms were made to make England have an actually credible army.
I mean, 30 Years' War was probably one of the most destructive wars by percentage of the population killed in all of human history.
Right, and that was a bunch of armies fighting each
basically
other.
Basically the First World War, before there was
any
World Wars.
Yeah, and it was also a way of fighting over who had sovereignty and all these other great things, right? There was, in no way was there a unified Europe world government with a giant army, and that's why the Pilgrims left.
Didn't a greater percentage of Germans die in that war than World War II?
I believe so. I think it was one-third of the population of northern Germany was killed during the 30 Years' War.
So, I mean, Europe, it's all the same.
Right, and so...
But I do like the... maybe it was about just they had a central government in Europe. I mean, because there was, like, some socialism involved.
It was a central government, which was Europe. That was his line.
Not really.
Except there was no part of that was correct. But yeah, so this is a man who's trying to argue based on an arcane and incorrect legal theory that the federal government can't make him pay to graze cattle on federally managed public lands. He literally believes that the 1620 Pilgrims had a revolution and flat earth sailed to America because they needed to escape a totalitarian government that ruled over all of Europe with a massive army. And somehow, despite a total lack of knowledge on the country's actual history to that point, to the point of not knowing the facts that the rest of us learned in like fifth grade, he's considered to be a patriot. And then all these people show up. I mean, these shooters in Nevada claimed that on social media that they had sold all of their belongings and moved to Nevada so that they could permanently help out in this glorious standoff against the federal government, and then end up just shooting some cops in the back of the head while they're eating pizza.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he's talking about black people freeloading on government assistance while he's refusing to pay his
millions of dollars in back fees,
grazing fees and all that. I mean, just a little ironic.
The problem is that a lot of this extremism has just gotten wrapped up into this whole big thing, this sovereigntist movement and this nationalist pro-white, but not openly saying pro-white movement.
It's bubbling under the surface a little bit.
It's all there and it's all interconnected, and it all ultimately is going to tie back to certain ideology. I mean, you even look at the so-called Reagan Democrats, right? And a lot of them are in the South or in various areas of the Northeast and more rural areas. And those so-called Reagan Democrats basically aligned with Reagan because they decided that the Democratic Party was getting too black. And some of them are still registered as Democrats. So periodically you'll see after something like this happens, you go, oh, well, that guy was actually a registered Democrat. And it's like, okay, he's a registered Democrat because he apparently never changed his party affiliation. But the rest of the party moved away from, for the most part, from those overtly nationalist positions and all that. And you know, no state is immune from this. It's come and gone in every part of the country. There, you know, in Massachusetts, for example, before the Civil War, had a period where the so-called Know-Nothings, the nativist party, or the very insultingly named Native American party at one point, which was basically anti-Irish for the most part and some other anti, you know, different ethnicities of Europe coming in, they won the state legislature in Massachusetts at one point. There was an election where they came in first with a plurality of the seats in the state legislature in Massachusetts. So this kind of thing has happened everywhere, but there are certain areas where it's all getting really blurry, and these are either the areas that have had this long, tenuous love-hate relationship with the federal government in the Mountain West, or this generally ongoing hate relationship with the federal government, excluding defense contracts and things like that, in the Deep South. And the problem with the Deep South, though, is that they have that legacy of chattel slavery on the plantation that's not found elsewhere. But some of that is then blurred out across the Mountain West and mixed in with these sovereigntist anti-governmental ideologies, like Bundy expresses, and eventually some people aren't just content to wave around guns. Sometimes they're going to go and attack government figures and try to assassinate them. And that's the problem. You got to be careful about the power of your words. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment.